This episode contains explicit language that is not bleeped.
It is difficult to make a real good omelette, and there is different type of omelette. I'm going to show you two type of omelette.
This is legendary chef Jacques Pepin demonstrating a classic French omelette. And this is Sammy Hagar's classic song, Mas Tequila. What does one have to do with the other? Well, Sammy is a legit rock star. He used to front Van Halen. But he says before he learned to rock, he learned to cook.
To me, I just want to take toasted French bread and some tomatoes and a little bit of basil and salt, pepper, and olive oil, and I'm good to go.
And it turns out Jacques Pepin's kind of a rock star in his own right. I mean, the guy knows how to party.
I bought 70 cases of wine this spring.
70 cases, yeah, 70 of cases. Wine? Oh,
we do drink a lot of wine.
And the similarities go a lot deeper. From their memorable childhood experiences with food to their passion for eating today, these two guys have a lot more in common than you ever imagined. Today on The Sporkful, Sammy and I talk about the art of making fresh mozzarella and what he learned about food from his Sicilian immigrant grandparents. Then Jacques and I drink beer out of paper cups and talk about his arrival in America and his first encounter with an Oreo cookie. By the end of the show, I think you'll find that neither of these guys is who you think they are. Stick around. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. In the 90s, Sammy Hagar opened his first Cabo Wabo Cantina restaurant and launched Cabo Wabo Tequila. He eventually sold the tequila company for $91 million. But times weren't always so flush for Sammy. In his cookbook, Are We Having Any Fun Yet? The Cooking and Partying Handbook, he describes his humble beginnings on food stamps. And he talks lovingly about his Sicilian grandparents who made all the classic Italian staples from scratch in their trailer. When I met up with Sammy, I brought him some fresh mozzarella from a place in Brooklyn called Caputo's. It was still warm.
Beautiful.
This mozzarella was pulled less than 2 hours ago.
Wow. That's an art form. You know, my grandpa did it. To me,
Sammy's grandparents drove their trailer up and down the American West, taking seasonal restaurant jobs for a few months at a time, then moving on.
They fought all the time, but they were never, you know, apart. I mean, it was like, you know, they did everything together because my grandpa couldn't read and write, and my grandma could, and he drove. She didn't know how to drive a car, so she read the map, the road sign, said, "Hey," you know, she called him Daddy. My mom called him Daddy. Everybody called him Daddy, but me, I call him Grandpa. And she'd go, "Daddy, you gotta go left up here," and say, "Well, son of a bitch, you gotta tell me sooner. I didn't see the turn." And then, you know, and they have a trailer behind them and a big old station wagon as big as a house itself. And they just would argue all the time.
Tell me about the time you found a dead deer on the side of a road.
Well, that was grandma now. Now we're talking grandma.
Right, now we're talking grandma. Tell me the story.
Well, my grandma and grandpa got in a big fight because my grandma would get drunk once in a while and she would, you know, that she would run away. And she usually would walk to our house and my mom would, you know, take care of her, right? And so she was at our house and I was going, it was on a weekend, and I was going up to see the band play with my buddies, three of us. I had 57 DeSoto, which has a huge trunk. It's a huge car to begin with, big old fins on it, you know. It's about three cars in one. And in front of us, we see this car. It's up in the mountains. We're going up to Crestline, Lake Arrowhead area. And a deer jumps out in front of the car, and the guy hits the damn deer and kills it, man. Boom, it flies over his car. He slams on the brakes, and he keeps going. And I'm going, stop. I'm going, shit. Come on, guys. Put this deer in the trunk. They go, what? I'm going, yeah, man. Come on. I knew what to do with that thing, right?
Right.
I was 17, you know, 16, 17. And, you know, these guys didn't want no part of it, man. Right. I said, don't worry about it, man. Come on, help me out. So we throw it in the trunk. We go out and party all night. Come on, midnight. My grandma's.
So you went to the concert?
Yeah, I went to the concert.
With a dead deer in your
with
trunk.
With a dead deer in the trunk. Okay. Obviously, we didn't pick up any girls. What do you got in the trunk? Yeah. I mean, I didn't even think about that, but right. No, we danced. I danced with girls, but I didn't try to take them home.
Right.
So
I'm glad you had your priorities straight.
Well, like, it wasn't really a priority, tonight. Brother. I'd have taken that deer and thrown it out of some fine girl wanted to ride in that trunk with me. So my grandma's sleeping on the couch. I walk in the house. I say, Grandma, I got a deer in the trunk, man. She shot up like a bullet, man. Where is it? How big is it? I said, come on, take a look. It was a doe, but it was a big one. And man, she was 5'1". If she was 5 foot, I don't think she was 5'1". She was like 4'5". You know, for little tiny Italian lady, skinny as hell, smoking a cigarette, drinking, poured herself a big glass of wine, comes walking out.
This is not like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, midnight, right. 1, 2, you know. She helps me rip that deer out. It's heavier and shit. Rigor mortis now. It's hard as a rock, you know, like you stiff as hell. And she goes, put it in the backyard. Come on, help me get it. We're dragging it in the backyard. We had a little lawn about, you know, backyard about this big with a lawn and a clothesline. And I said, okay, Grandma, I'm going to bed. She's sharpening knives up, man, getting ready to go. I wake up in the morning. My mom's screaming, oh, my God. Screaming like, oh, my God. And my grandma's sitting there in her nightgown, you know, smoking a cigarette, still drinking wine, blood all over her. And that deer's hanging on the clothesline. It's skinned up. The skin's laying out. The chops are all in stacks. My mom telling the story later said, oh, my God, I thought Mommy killed Daddy. like her dad came over to get her and she killed his ass.
Right.
And I'm telling you, that's how crazy things were, you know. But we ate that venison forever. But she butchered a freaking deer.
So that was Sammy's grandma. Then there was Grandpa Sam. He was also a real character. For one thing, whenever he'd leave a restaurant job, he'd clean the place out.
He was kind of a thief when he'd work in restaurants. He would load that car up, man, with always it was the same stuff. It was quarts of whipping cream, and it was big pound slabs of butter,
right?
And it was filet mignon that was in the big shrink wrap things, you know, like about, you know, 20 pounds of filets. You know, sometimes he'd bring a big old 5-gallon tub of ice cream, you know, and we'd see him coming with it, pulling his trailer. He wouldn't even go home first, man. We'd say, here comes Grandpa with the bounty, man. We'd all run out there, jump around the car, and we'd be eating steaks for a few months and making our own butter out of the cream and making whipping cream and putting cream on our cereal instead of skim milk. Anyway, so it was just great. You know, we just loved Grandpa's, the fact that he was a thief.
And you said that he made his own salamis, he pulled his own mozzarella. Like,
totally.
What was it like walking into that trailer?
I'm telling you, it was like a deli. When you parked your car, you'd smell it. Especially in the summer, if he had it all opened up. And if not, if it was in the winter and he had it closed up and you walked in there, man, it was, you opened that door, it's like, oh my God, I just want to live here.
You say that you learned to cook even before you learned to rock.
Well, absolutely.
Tell me about one of your earliest memories of cooking something and having that experience as a kid.
I remember coming home from school, and my mom was working, and I was home first, and nobody around. I was starving, so I just started digging around, and it's in my book, and we had those little pop-open biscuits where you hit them on the side, and they bust open. And so I whipped one out, and I took some spaghetti sauce, and I rolled it out, and some the green mozzarella cheese, the same thing, you know, the Parmesan, the Romano, whatever, the green vial. We had some of that in there, some old crap that, you know, it was so hard. But anyway, I sprinkled it all over the top.
And right, like the store-bought supermarket Parmesan cheese.
Yeah, because that's all that was in the refrigerator, basically, right. You know. And I put it in the oven. I don't know how I thought about what temperature or whatever, but it puffed up. And it was good, man. And I thought, holy shit, you know. So when my brother came home from school, I made him one. And my brother was 3 years older than me, so he picked on me. I was like, you know, shut up. You don't know nothing. Wait till mom leaves. I'm going to beat the shit out of you, you know. We had that kind of relationship.
Right.
And so I thought, I'm going to blow his mind. And I made it. And he said, wow, Sammy, that was good, man. Make another one. And I was so high. I thought, wow, my brother likes me, man. He's going to treat me good now. Right. But that was only for another day. But that was the first.
But still,
time.
That feeling. You had that feeling.
It totally made me think I can cook.
Right.
Yeah. And I stuck with it. So, and the same thing with writing a song. You know, the first time you write a song, you play it for your buddies or your girlfriend, and they go, wow, that's really great.
So how is cooking like rocking?
It's not as much like rocking as it is like songwriting. So, you know, you're going to write a song. I don't have an idea. I just kind of think, I kind of want to write a kind of a mellow song. So I go get an acoustic guitar to start with. And I start playing a melody and some chord changes. And then you go, okay, now I need some words. So then you write some words. And then when you're all done with it, you're going, now, you know what it needs? It needs like a bass guitar and just some bongos and a shaker. And then this is perfect. This song is right, right? That's like cooking. You go, well, I'm going to start with a chicken. Right?
Right.
And then you just start going. And it's exactly the same process when you cook creatively. They are both equally, I can't say as rewarding financially, but they're both equally as rewarding, you know, to your emotion, your physical, and your spiritual side of you going, I just wrote a great song, I'm so happy. Or I just made this fantastic meal, I'm really, really happy. And that's note for note. It's very, very similar. You got a bad reputation.
A bad reputation. That's Sammy Hagar. His cookbook is Are We Having Any Fun Yet? The Cooking and Partying Handbook. And Sammy's graduated from Biscuit Dough Pizza. I've got to say, this book includes recipes for tuna ceviche, paella, and a lot more. And speaking of paella, I got to say, one of my favorite parts of Sammy's book is he talks about how, so he's friends with Tommy Lee, the drummer from Motley Crue, Natch. And Tommy Lee also likes to cook. So Sammy got Tommy a paella making kit as a gift. And now, whenever Tommy Lee makes paella, he takes photos of his paella and texts them to Sammy Hagar. I mean, who knew rock stars could be so adorable? Coming up, I'll talk with legendary French chef Jacques Pepin. And I think you'll hear why this segue isn't nearly as bizarre as it may sound. Jacques will explain why he keeps his beer in the fridge next to his truffles, and why, when he goes into a restaurant kitchen, the first place he looks is in the garbage. Stick around. Where everybody knows your name, expecting you to stay the same. Either put it up or they'll put you out. That's what they do when you got a bad reputation. A bad reputation. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you get it. That way, you'll never miss an episode. It also helps us to rise in the rankings. It helps other people discover our show, so everyone wins. Go ahead, you can subscribe right now while you're listening. Thanks. Jacques Pepin was a celebrity chef before anyone had ever heard of such a thing. Way before there could be two whole cable networks devoted entirely to food and cooking, Jacques Pepin, Julia Child, and a few others paved the way. A year ago, Jacques celebrated his 80th birthday with the release of his 25th cookbook, Jacques Pepin, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen. I'd read that he enjoys a good beer, so when he came into the studio, I had some ready.
Yes. Good. I do it with a knife or with a fork anyway. Yeah.
I'll get mine.
Well.
Oh, you're pouring it into the paper cup. This is so great. I'm pouring mine into a paper cup, too.
Yeah, I like it out of a glass better than out of a...
At the bottom. Why?
I don't know why, because maybe I'm a slob, and when I drink directly at the bottom, it already ends up on my shirt.
Well, cheers. We can't get a clinking sound effect because now we're drinking beer out of paper cups.
Okay, well, that's good. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Do you ever get concerned about, this is one of my calculations I make when I'm eating, is that I don't want to drink too much beer when my focus is on the food, because I'll feel too full and I can't eat as much. Is that a concern for you ever?
Never. I'm a real glutton, you know.
I read that you keep beer in your fridge next to the truffles.
Right.
Why?
Because if people ask you, do you have a beer? You say, yeah, it's next to the truffle in the refrigerator. So, sounds good. You know, so.
But it seems like you get a kick out of that sort of combining highbrow and lowbrow.
Yes, I mean, you know, we are, you know, certainly 30 years ago, any good mother would have wanted her child to marry a doctor, a lawyer, or an architect, certainly not a cook. And now we are genius, you know. And I don't know what happened, but I mean, I'm enjoying it. But...
You came of age in France during the Second World War.
Right.
How did that affect your approach to food?
Well, I am extremely miserly in the kitchen, and that's probably because of my mother, aunt, and all this. I mean, food was kind of scarce, and nothing was wasted. I mean, still now, whether I do consulting work in restaurant or even when I go in a restaurant like this, I am drawn right away to the garbage can to see what's in there. And I get crazy most of the time, like off bread in there. I mean, you have broccoli. That gets me crazy. You know?
Do you remember your parents? Like, do you remember that being like them teaching you that? Do you remember specific moments
of that? No. It was just part of life. I mean, certainly my mother died last year. She was 99 and a half. So my father died many, many years ago. And it was my mother cooking because she had a little restaurant. Actually, there were seven women who had restaurants in my family. I'm the first male to go into that business. And even after I had been the chef to the French president, you know, in the 50s, working in the biggest place in Paris, if I get back home to my aunt and all that, I go into the kitchen and say, get out of here, you dirty too many pots, you use too much butter. So there were no time press at all.
You say you never spend more than $12 for a bottle of wine.
Right? Well, I do sometimes more, but on the whole, you're right. I bought 70 cases of wine this spring.
70 cases
yeah, 70
of
cases.
Wine?
Oh, we do drink a lot of wine. At my house when we
That's
do the
exactly
big party.
The number of cases of wine I would have hoped you would have bought.
Yeah, right.
You came to America in 1959.
Right.
What was American food like when you got here? Like, or what was your reaction to it?
Well, it was another world altogether. There was only one salad, and that was iceberg. There was no mushroom. I remember I live on 50th and First Avenue. I think it was D'Agostino Brother, one of those. And I go there and I say, Supermarket. Where are the mushrooms? They say, aisle 5. And that was canned mushroom. You had to go to a specialty store.
just to get fresh mushrooms.
Yeah, or parsley even.
Wow.
It was amazing. But on the other hand, you know, it was my first supermarket. Because in France, supermarket had not started. And so I thought it was fantastic.
Tell me about the first time you ate an Oreo cookie.
Ooh. I don't remember the first time. I think it may have been at Pierre Frenet. He was the executive chef of the Pavillon, became kind of my older brother, like mentor, and took me to his house in East Hampton. He had a little house in the spring in East Hampton, a summer cottage. I remember the first time that I had for breakfast, his wife gave me those little package in cardboard with a dotted line in the middle that you cut through, you open it, and that was a cornflake in the middle of that.
Oh, right. Yes, the little cereal box that turns into the bowl.
And you
yes.
pour it directly. I thought that was really neat. And I love the taste of, I still love cornflake now. I mix it with chocolate. But at that point, it may have been that time I had a Oreo cookie, and I liked it. I still like it.
Let's talk for a minute about tuna tartare and bagel chips.
Oh.
One of the recipes in your book. I love that it includes bagel chips.
Right.
Describe your favorite bagel chip to me. Do you like the ones that are really thin and a little bit burnt, or do you like the ones that are thicker and a little bit softer?
No, the first one, the one which are really crunchy.
You like a lot of crunch.
Right. You know, I may be looked at the quintessential French chef, and you open the restaurant and I have an eggplant Chinese style. I have a shirashi sushi. I have raw fish like this one, which did not exist when I was a kid. You know, after over half a century in America, I've absorbed so many other type of cuisine that this is really a very American book in that sense. Especially I've been married for 50 years to a woman born in New York City from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father. So all of that. And I don't think that I was ever very chauvinistic about my food. I remember my mother coming here 40 years ago and eating my food and said, wow, this is good, but it's not French. I said, no, maybe it's not. So I never really tried to be French totally. And by the same token, I don't try not to be French. I don't really think in those terms.
I host this show here. I'm not a chef.
Yes.
I like to eat. Somehow I managed to convince people to give me a job doing this. There are times when I'm in a sort of more high-end food circle.
Right.
And I kind of look around and I kind of feel like I don't belong here.
Right.
Like I don't have the knowledge, or I just sort of like I don't have the taste. I don't understand. And maybe that's my own insecurity, but I'm curious like.
No, I feel the same way.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Now, tonight, we're going to have dinner at Magnus Nelson, you know, famous chef from Fakit. And if I eat at Dan Barber or any of the great chefs like this, I mean, it blew my mind because I wouldn't even know where to start, what they did, you know. So I said, wow, I mean, this is amazing. Now, is that what I want to eat every day? Probably not.
So when you're in one of those situations where you feel like maybe you don't belong, or it's one of these high-end molecular gastronomy situations. Right. What do you do?
Well, no, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's a different approach. You know, when I cook, I want to please people. I want them to be able to identify the food and already make a pairing in their head, they say, and start salivating, say, that's going to be great with a cabernet, whatever. So there is that communion, if you want, or that interchange between the person you're going to feed, the feeder, and the feedee. But molecular cooking, that is exactly the opposite. It's a trip for the chef. The idea is to stamp you. But special occasion is special occasion. You do, otherwise you go back to a beer and a taco, you know.
You said that this is your last big cookbook, at least. I know you got some other ideas in the works, but sort of right. Last big cookbook TV series. But you haven't ruled out, in particular, a project with your granddaughter.
Right.
What do you like to cook with her?
Well, you know, the lesson of a grandfather, you know, doing little things. I enjoy cooking with her, teasing her, and she's 11 years old now. I started when she was like 4 or 5. Cooking with her, and it's always fun. I mean, and there is nothing like cooking with your kid in the kitchen. I mean, when my daughter was 1.5 years old, I hold her in my arm and make her stir the pot. So she, quote, stir the pot, she, quote, made it.
Right.
So she was going to eat it. So that's very important to get the family involved. I mean, there is no place like the kitchen for a child coming back from school. You hear the noise of the kitchen, the clink, the smell of that kitchen, the taste, voice of your father, your mother. That stay with you the rest of your life. It's very visceral.
And many years from now,
when I'm dead.
Maybe when we're all dead.
Right.
When your grandkids are grandparents themselves.
Oh, boy.
What do you hope that they'll say are their special food memories from cooking with you?
I hope that they will do some of those tastes that I did for their kid, and I hope that when they do it, they have a smile on their face, you know, that I brought some pleasure in their life. And that's what the food does. I mean, you know, you bring pleasure to people, and that's how I would like to be remembered. I mean, the table is a great equalizer. I mean, they may sit you in a table next to the CEO of General Motors that you don't know, they don't know you. They start talking to you two around the table. In a normal situation, they will never speak to you. But the table is the equalizer there, you know, around the table cares. So that's a great way of spending your life.
Jacques Pepin, it's a real honor to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for the beer. I just finished it.
All right.
That's good.
Perfect timing then.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
I've got to say, I really loved hearing how much Jacques and Sammy have in common. You hear a guy like Jacques Pepin talk about coming home from school as a kid and the sounds and the smells of the kitchen. That could just easily be Sammy Hagar walking into his grandparents' trailer. And you hear Sammy talk about how it made him feel when his older brother liked his pizza. You know, that's the same feeling that Jacques Pepin's been chasing his whole life. Like he said, bringing pleasure to other people. And I really love what Jacques said about how the table is the great equalizer. You know, I like to think of this show as sort of a big dinner table. You know, the kind of place where Sammy Hagar and Jacques Pepin end up side by side with you and me. That does it for this week. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you get it. That way you'll never miss an episode. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani, Shoshana Gold, and me. Engineering help from Jason Isaac. Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Nora from Taylor, Texas, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.